When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Amateur Traveler, episode 873. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about dugout canoes and dinghies, tropical birds and skull caves, guest houses and kula traders, as we go to Papua New Guinea. This is Chris Christensen from Amateur Traveler. Let's talk about Papua New Guinea. I'd like to welcome to the show Chris Shorrock from TravelObscure.com, who's come to talk to us about Papua New Guinea. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
As we said beforehand, I feel like with TravelObscure.com that maybe I shouldn't mention it if you were trying to keep it obscure, but that is not what you intended with the website name.
No, the travel is obscure, but we're hoping the blog will not be so obscure.
Obscure like Papua New Guinea.
Exactly, yeah.
Excellent. And what is your connection with Papua New Guinea? Why are we talking about Papua New Guinea?
I don't really have a specific connection apart from that I wanted to go for a very long time. During the COVID lockdowns here in New Zealand, I couldn't work. And I ambitiously in 2020 planned a trip for Christmas 2020 to Papua New Guinea. And I specifically chose Milne Bay province in Papua New Guinea because it's a good time to travel there over the Christmas break. So that's really the connection. I've wanted to go for a really long time. I did a lot of research and that was the best place to go in Papua New Guinea over the Christmas break. Obviously, we didn't go in 2020 because we're still through COVID. So we waited a few years and we went Christmas 2022 instead.
Excellent. And why should someone go to Papua New Guinea?
There's a million reasons why someone should go to Papua New Guinea. It's such a varied country, but specifically Milne Bay province in Papua New Guinea, which is what I'm going to talk about today. I would say main reasons to go, the people are amazing, some of the most generous people, the most friendly people, and there's a lot of culture there as well. Papua New Guinea itself has over 800 different languages. Milne Bay province, probably, I think there's at least 50 different languages and lots of different cultures and cultural practices that are still quite current today, but go many hundreds of years back into the past. Also, amazing natural environment. We think in jungle-clad islands, beautiful coral reefs, dolphins, birds of paradise, pristine rainforest. And then basically no other tourists. So that was a big draw for me. It's not a very touristy destination. And there's lots of reasons for that, but that was a big draw as well. The fact that it's quite off the beaten track and obscure.
Excellent. And we've done at least one other episode, I think two other episodes on Papua New Guinea, one relatively recently, one a long time ago. But they were a different portion, different kind of experience. What kind of itinerary are you going to lay out for us here?
So this is going to be roughly a week long, but with some optional add-ons to that. And it will start off in the capital of Milne Bay province, which is Alatau, and go over to East Cape and to a few days at a dive resort on the mainland, and then a couple of islands off the shore in the D'Entrecasteaux Islands, and then a couple of additional extras in the Louisiade island chain further south.
Excellent. You started us in Alatau. Is that how
Alatau,
you say it?
Alatau, yeah.
Alatau. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so obviously for people coming from abroad, you're going to fly into Port Moresby, which is the capital of Papua New Guinea, and they have flights from mostly Australia or Asia. So from there, there's no road connection to Alatau, even though it is also on mainland Papua New Guinea. So you have to take an internal flight from Port Moresby to Alatau. I would recommend taking Air New Guinea. We booked with PNG Air, which is a smaller airline, and we had problems with cancellations and missing connections and things like that. So Air New Guinea flies every day, and they're much more reliable. So I would say fly Air New Guinea to Alatau. Alatau is where you're going to start. Now, that is the only place in the whole province which has banks, which has a post office, which has supermarkets. So once you're out of Alatau, you're not going to the cash machine. You need to make sure you've got enough cash for your whole trip before you leave Alatau. So like, we could only get a certain amount out each time we went to the cash machine. So we got some out in Port Moresby when we arrived and some out in Alatau to make sure we had enough for the whole trip. So any shopping, any supplies you need to get them before you leave Alatau. We booked to stay at Tawali Dive Resort when we arrived in Milne Bay province. And that's because it's a bit of an intimidating place to travel to. And we thought, staying in a dive resort, they pick you up from the airport, they transport you to the dive resort via a shuttle bus and then a boat to get to the dive resort. And that was just quite nice because it didn't mean we were dealing with public transport or anything like that initially. And we could get our bearings and settle into Papua New Guinea a little bit before we struck out on our own, because we were traveling independently. So that was quite nice. And they took us around Alatau to pick up the things we needed and go to the cash machines and things. And it's a very picturesque drive along the coast towards East Cape, which is the most easterly point of mainland Papua New Guinea. And close to there, they dip down to the coast and you get on their boat, which takes you to the dive resort. Again, the dive resort is on the mainland, but there's no road access to it. So you've got to take a boat to get there. We stayed 2 nights and that was fine. You could stay longer. I had planned to do some diving, but in the end I didn't because I got a bit of a cold and that's not ideal for diving. It's a really nice place to be, like beautiful ocean views from our little, what would I call it? A cabin bungalow situation with a veranda, okay. Overlooked a bay and the rainforest clad hills, and there's sulfur crested cockatoos flying by and lots of tropical butterflies and things, and just a really nice place to sit and relax. We didn't just sit and relax, but it is a nice place to just relax.
Theoretically, one
could. Yeah, you can. We did spend time relaxing and it was very relaxing. It's quite a hot, it's a very hot place. We are on a boat through the ocean, we're on a bus, it's hot at the airport, it's quite full on. The airport experience in Port Moresby, because it's just chaos. There's no obvious lines. Definitely want to get there early for your internal flight because it takes quite a bit of time to get through. By the time we arrived, we were hot, we were tired. They had cold towels for us when we arrived to wipe ourselves down and coconut drinks and things, which was nice. And a very nice pool, which is almost essential because it's so hot. We spent a lot of time when we went doing things just in the pool, in the shade, keeping cool. This was early in our trip, so we hadn't adjusted to the heat quite yet. So that was a good option to start with. As far as things to do there, they've got an amazing reef that runs right around the coast where the dive resort is. So we did some snorkeling there, lots of colourful corals, a bit of a drop-off, lots of obviously lots of tropical fish. And there's great diving there. While we were there, I think the day that we arrived, they'd seen a couple of manta rays on the dive. So there's lots to see, especially under the water if you're into diving. We also took a boat trip up the coast one day. So it's the Skull Cave trip.
I saw that.
Yeah. So these are very common in this part of Papua New Guinea, especially. A lot of places will have their own ancestral skull cave. So this was a trip to a skull cave up the coast.
So these are ancestors, not tourists per se.
Definitely not tourists. So this is from before the days when there was any tourists. So I can confirm it's not tourists. And they're definitely older than the days when tourists were going to this part of Papua New Guinea. So we got a boat up the coast. We picked up a guide from one of the villages, which was interesting because he got onto the boat along a tree branch and then jumped down to the boat from the shore. So we thought we were going to be getting out onto the tree branch. So we were quite glad when he got in rather than us having to climb out onto the tree branch. We got out and so we go into the skull cave and it's a small entrance. It's not very big inside, but you can stand up. And there was big mounds of human skulls inside the cave, hence the skull cave. And he had a couple of stories, so a couple of options of why this cave was full of skulls. The first one, one of the main things that people ask when you go into Papua New Guinea is, oh, be careful you don't get eaten by the cannibals. The first story was about cannibalism and how this was somewhere where people would hide and they would go out and catch people, eat them, and then, or bring them back to the cave and then eat them and throw the skulls there. So that was the first story, but I'm not sure if that's more for the tourist kind of cannibal story than anything else. The other story, which we heard other places as well, was that they used to bury their dead with their head out of the ground and a clay pot over the head, and they would wait until the head was removable, take the head off and dry it above the fire in their hut, and then they would keep it as a memory of the person that had passed away. Now, when missionaries came to Papua New Guinea, they weren't particularly keen on this practice, and people with their heads that they had kept of their relatives then hid them in the caves to keep them away from the missionaries and stop them from taking the heads. That's another story. And then the guide added that missionaries brought cameras as well, so they didn't have to keep the heads anymore of their relatives because they could take a picture and keep the picture afterwards instead.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's quite interesting. Like, it's an interesting cultural experience. And right. And then from there, we got back on the boat and we went up the coast a bit further to a waterfall and hiked inland just maybe 5 or 10 minutes to this nice tropical waterfall where we could have a swim and a relax. And again, it's really hot, so it was really nice to cool off and just relax in the waterfall for a while before we went back. That was the main trip that we did while we were staying at Tawali.
Okay.
And there, it's like a buffet style meal situation, but the food was very nice. And like a nice outdoor seating area overlooking the ocean. It's quite a relaxing, easy place to just ease into Papua New Guinea. Now, for traveling Papua New Guinea, obviously, it's not as safe as traveling in Europe or Asia. So we were getting ideas from the staff there of like how safe it was to do our planned route, which was taking dinghies to these offshore islands. And I think it's important if you're traveling in Papua New Guinea to get a good idea of the safety situation beforehand and also when you get there, because things do change. Now, we were going reasonably soon after Papua New Guinea opened after the pandemic. So it was a bit hard to gauge the safety situation because there wasn't many previous tourists to judge the safety situation off. But we checked all the government travel advisory websites like the British and the American and all that sort of thing. And there was nothing to say that what we planned wasn't safe particularly. But there had been some reports of piracy. So we definitely researched about that before we set off on the trip. And we asked a lot of locals when we got there as well. And the other thing that is an issue in Papua New Guinea is the rascals, which is basically just people that will rob traffic on the roads, essentially. So it's hard to gauge how much of an issue that is, but it's definitely not targeted towards tourists. It's more of they will target people on the way back from the market, that sort of thing. And it's not super frequent from what we could understand anyway. There'd also been a task force that had gone out recently and the piracy had gone down quite a lot since the police task force was patrolling the waters around Mumbai province. But staying at Tawali was a good way of assessing the situation before we decided what we did next. So from there, we then went to East Cape. So Tawali, they will run tours to East Cape, which is the most easterly point that you can get to on the Papua New Guinea mainland. And from there, that's where a lot of the dinghies to the outer islands will travel from. So we went out with Tawali and some people did the tour. And it's quite, it is intimidating, I think, especially because we hadn't traveled since before the pandemic. It was quite intimidating just then being in a developing country again. So we did the tour with the guys from Tawali around East Cape before then going to get our dinghy across to Normanby Island. And we were, and it was quite good because the guide from Tawali handed us over to somebody in East Cape who helped us find the dinghy and all that sort of thing. So it's nice if people, you can reference who you're going to stay with and if the other people everyone knows everyone there. So it's quite good if you have a name that you can say, oh, we're going to see this guy. When people ask, they're like, oh, I know him, blah, blah, blah. And it's quite a good way of chatting to locals and getting to know people. So from Tuwali, we went to East Cape, and from there, we'd already arranged a boat ride across to Sewa Bay on Normanby Island. And we arranged that through Waiaki Samani, who owns Sibanai Guesthouse on Normanby Island. Normanby Island is one of the D'Entrecasteaux Islands, which is just off the eastern tip of Papua New Guinea.
When you say just off, 10 miles or so off. So
is that what it is? Okay.
A little far for a dinghy.
Okay, yeah. So dinghy, that's like a banana boat. So maybe it's, I don't know, maybe they're 6-5 meters long, something like that. Okay. Open boat with an outboard motor on the back. Now, we actually got a boat, so it was like a covered boat. And that Waiaki from the guest house arranged that for us. It was still a public boat, so there was other people on the boat as well. But okay. It was a bigger boat than a dinghy to get across there. And it's relatively easy if you arrange with the guest house owners beforehand. They can arrange either a private dinghy or private boat to take you to the guest house. Or we were on a bit of a budget, so we went with a public dinghy. But he arranged our places on the boat before we left.
Okay.
Boat ride takes about an hour. It's a very beautiful ride. Anywhere in Milne Bay province is very beautiful because it's tropical rainforest clad islands and beautiful blue ocean everywhere. Very beautiful ride over. Normanby Islands, covered in rainforest, mountainous island. As you approach, you can smell the rainforest before you get there. So there's this earthy smell as you approach the island. And as we were getting there, the sun was setting, it was dusk. These steep rainforest clad hillsides coming down to these little stilt villages along the shore. People had their cooking fires going. It's like a little entrance to the bay, and then it opens out into this big, calm bay with these little villages. And there's no lights, there's just the little cooking fires. And it's like you're entering in a different world, like you're going back in time. Maybe a few people on outrigger canoes in the bay, and we just zipped through in the dinghy, but it was just super beautiful and just entering a different world. So we spent 5 nights at Sibanai Guesthouse. Now, I wouldn't recommend that you need 5 nights. I think 2 or 3 nights would be totally fine. We had an issue with it being a public holiday and a lack of fuel to get back. So we were there a little bit longer. You have to be a little bit flexible when you're traveling in Papua New Guinea. Yeah, the fuel depot had run out of fuel in Alatau, so there was no fuel on the island. So then we were waiting for people to come back from Alatau with fuel to then carry on our trip. But you've got to be ready for a few little kind of twists and turns in the plan. So we were there a little bit longer than we'd planned on being. But there, this is a guest house, maybe a few hundred meters back from the water's edge. You walk through a small village into the rainforest, and this is just inside the rainforest. So you're surrounded by these massive rainforest trees next to a forest stream, and there's just life all around you. So there's so many lorikeets and parrots and cockatoos, butterflies. It's a really amazing place to be. So again, it's a nice place just to be there and experience the rainforest, but there's also lots of things you can do there as well. So the first day we got there, Waiaki took us on a tour to the forest garden. So
okay.
It's mostly subsistence farming on all these outer islands, farming and fishing, basically. And so he took us into the forest, to the forest garden. So they will fell a small portion of the forest, plant their gardens, and then after a few years, they'll allow the forest to regrow and they'll move to another section where they've probably farmed previously, but not for quite a few years. I think they leave at least 10 years in between each time they farm there, and they'll farm for a few years before they move on. So he took us into the forest, and we saw massive hornbills flying through the forest. It's a walk through the forest. It is hot, but there's just so much life there. It's amazing. And Waiaki would show us the medicinal plants, so some that they would boil up and use it for diabetes, and some that they would rub on cuts to help stop the bleeding. And we turned a corner at one point, and then there's these massive wing beats through the forest. Just felt, it sounded like the biggest thing ever, and these massive Blythe's hornbills were just flying down the track ahead of us. And he's really into birds. So he will, Wayaki, the owner of the lodge, will take people looking for new species of birds and people that are really keen on birds. And he knows every bird in the forest. So if you're into birds, it's a great place to go.
ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got, packed with dry ice, came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts, 2 steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping as always, curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. I also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way as I send my thanks to ButcherBox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
He was not bothered by these Blythe hornbills, I think because they're quite common out there. But for us that have not really experienced that before, it was amazing. They were just ginormous. It was really cool. So we got to the gardens and he showed us the gardens and he was explaining how it all works. And there's a lot of magic in these communities. So magic is still a big part of their lives. And he was telling us the yams are, they're the symbol of success. So if you have a big yam harvest, then you'll show that off and people are like, oh, he's got a lot of yams. He's pretty special. And he was explaining that everyone has their own special mix of herbs that they will mix before the yam harvest and rub on the yams before they plant the yams. And it's a big secret. So people will go out to plant the yams early in the morning so nobody can see their secret mix of herbs. And his sister or sister-in-law, she gets the best and the biggest yams. So this year he had got his sister-in-law to come and use her special herb mixture on his yams. He obviously wasn't there because she won't let him find out what her mixture is. But she had rubbed all her herbs on his yams. So he was hoping for a good harvest this year because he got the special herb mixture from his sister. So that was quite cool. There's just a lot of those different kind of beliefs that make it a very interesting place to go and travel and speak to people there. We walk
now,
back.
When we talk about a tropical stay, I feel that some people are picturing the over-the-water bungalows and the lagoons and the 5-star service. I gather that's not what we're talking about here.
That is not what we're talking about here, no. So when we arrived at Sivanai Guest House, we had been waiting for the boat for quite a few hours in East Cape, and it was hot and we were sweaty. And we'd been traveling, like we'd been on the way there for maybe 6-7 hours. Mm-hmm. So when we got there, Wayaki wasn't there yet. He was making his way back from Alatau. And so his wife was there. And I asked, oh, is there somewhere to wash? And she just spoke to the kid and was like, show them the river. While she was in the river, washing clothes was in the river, drinking water was from the river. So it's a very basic.
I'm seeing a one thatched guest house hut that can accommodate five people.
So we had a couple of different guest house huts. So we were in one with that has three separate rooms that come out onto a little veranda. And there was another one that I think had maybe three, maybe a double bed and two single beds and a little veranda that was self-contained. And then there's another one that had been built by some Swiss bird watchers that I think had a few more beds, and that was a self-contained guest house as well. And then they have a separate kitchen area where the table and where you eat and all that sort of thing. Now, normally I think the facilities would be better because there was a shower and there was a flush toilet, but we were there quite soon after the pandemic, so there'd been no tourists for a couple of years. He'd actually just rebuilt the cooking dining hut because the other one had gone into disrepair during the pandemic, and I think he was expecting that the plumbing was still working, but it wasn't. So that was something that would probably not be the same now. I don't think you would be washing in the river now, but when we were there, we were. Now, we always take water purification tablets if we're going traveling anyway, so it wasn't a problem for us. We just got the water from further upstream from where people were washing, and we used water purification tablets, and we were totally fine. But definitely you would want to go with water purification tablets. And I would also say, if you're getting the dinghies for transport between the island, you should take your own life jacket, which we did, because they don't normally have life jackets. So we just got the little life jackets that fit around your waist, and then the self-inflating ones.
Got it.
That's a good thing to take if you are going to do the dinghy option rather than a kind of private tour. Definitely take your own life jacket. It's very hot and there's no air conditioning.
You've mentioned that a few times.
Yeah.
Can we define very hot?
It's very humid, so it's probably not actually very hot, but I think it would be in the 30s, probably low 30s, but very high humidity, so it feels really hot. We actually spent a lot of time when we weren't doing much in the river, just sitting there, because that was nice and cool, and it was quite a nice place to just relax and be cool for a while. You do get used to it, but this was early in the trip, so we weren't quite used to it yet.
Okay. For my American friends, we're talking in the 90s with high humidity. Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not good at the Fahrenheit
That's
stuff.
That's not a
problem. I think in the 90s. Yeah, so we did the garden trip, which was very interesting. And then Waiaki is a big birder, so he's really good with the birds. And it's about a two-hour walk from the guest house that you get to a display site for the Goldie's Birds of Paradise, which are endemic to the D'Entrecasteaux Islands, which is three islands off the coast of mainland Papua New Guinea. So we did a trip, we hiked there with Waiaki to see the Goldie's Birds of Paradise. Now, we were outside of the display season, which I think runs from September to November, where the male birds of paradise display, and it's quite reliable that they will be there displaying in the early morning. It was just outside that time when we got there, so we didn't actually see them, but we did see lots of other birds like lorikeets and hornbills and things like that. So it was still an interesting trip. And honestly, Waiaki would have just stayed until we saw the birds of paradise. I think he's used to real keen bird watchers, and he said they will just stay until they see it. So he was off trying to find it in the forest, and we were like, no, it's fine. Let's just go back and have lunch. So we went back down. You need to be quite fit for this bit, because it was probably about an hour through the forest on reasonably flat, and then quite a steep uphill for quite a while, very steep. And it's obviously hot, so take plenty of water, and you need to be reasonably fit. We hiked back down, and his family had all come out to the river in the forest, and his wife had cooked a big meal, and we had a picnic by the river and swam in the river. And that was just like super relaxing, and spending time with the family. So it's a proper kind of homestay feel to it as well.
Okay.
Another really fun thing to do there is to go out into the bay. Now, there's good snorkeling, or the best snorkeling, Waiaki said, was out of the bay and up the coast a little bit. And if you hire a dinghy, you can go up there, and he said it's amazing snorkeling. hiring a dinghy is a bit more costly. So we opted for the cheap version, which was hiring a dugout canoe and canoeing out into the bay to an island in the bay where we went snorkeling. So that was really cool because these canoes, so I had read before I went about this anthropologist called Maronislav Baranovsky, who went to the Trobriand Islands, which are further north in Milne Bay. And he studied the people there and very interesting culture and all that sort of thing. But he talked in detail about how they make the canoes. So they make it from a single piece of wood and carve right. it out. And then they have the outrigger from a different tree, which is more buoyant. And it's all connected without any nails, just with forest materials. And that was from the early 1900s. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, but we probably won't see that because that's probably not a thing anymore. And then when we got there, everybody was using these canoes that were just the same as what he described in the early 1900s, only made from bush materials, no nails, nothing like that. So we took one of these out and paddled out with Wayaki and some of the kids to an island in the bay and went snorkeling around the island. Now, the snorkeling wasn't spectacular, but the canoe ride past the mangroves and past the stilt villages with the lorikeets and the cockatoos going past was really beautiful. And the bay is just all surrounded by rainforest clad hills and these little forest gardens that you can see amongst it. We saw an osprey catch a fish, just a really amazing experience. Besides that, because we got stuck there for a bit longer, we were there for New Year, so we had New Year there, and Wayaki and his family put on a massive feast and all the relatives came over. They made what they called mona, which is a special dish for special occasions, cooked out of a traditional clay pot, which come in from some islands miles away that have the special clay for the special pot. And it's cooked with coconut and forest greens, basically dough balls cooked in forest green coconut water.
Okay.
But that was very interesting. And we had so many different fruits and vegetables and everything they grow themselves. So it's either grown themselves, a bit of tinned fish, mostly fresh fish, and then everything else is from the garden, rice from Alatau, but that's about it really.
Okay.
I think that's about it with for Sibenai. From there, if you hire a dinghy, you can go straight up to Ferguson Island, which is where we went next, but we were doing it on the cheap, so we got a public dinghy back to East Cape and then from there up to Ferguson Island. I would say if you are doing it on public transport with the public dinghies, it's best to go up to Ferguson Island at the end of the week, so like a Thursday or a Friday, and then back on a Monday, because the villagers will come down at the start of the week, go to Alatau and head back towards the end of the week. So if you want a public dinghy heading back to the island, it's best at the end of the week. For Normanby Island, where Sibenai is, they go daily because it's a shorter distance. So
sure.
They go out to the island in the evening and come back in the morning. Dayday, which is on Ferguson Island, so the next island up in the Dentrocasteaux chain, we had chosen to go there because it has hot springs. Now, there's not that much online about these hot springs. We read about them, sounded interesting, we thought we'd go. It was quite amazing how extensive they were. We stayed at Dayday Guest House, which is another kind of basic guest house. They had a generator, so there was electricity in the evenings and a fan, which was nice, but still reasonably basic, right on the waterfront. And from there, it's about a 30-minute walk to the Dayday Hot Springs. Now, this is not like in New Zealand, we have hot springs and geothermal areas and mostly quite well-marked walkways and paths and fences. This is not that.
This I knew that's where that sentence was going. Yeah.
I'm quite a large person, so I'm quite tall and a lot heavier than the locals. So I was happy to have a guide, but I was also still a little bit worried that I might go through the crust somewhere, but I didn't. And it was very important to have a guide because they can take you where it's safe to walk, essentially. This is like a living area where people, the locals, will walk through on their morning to the forest gardens, and on the way back, they will cook their food in the hot springs. On the way back, they will do their washing in the hot springs, so wash their clothes, they will bathe in the hot springs, and then they'll walk home. So it's really like a part of the community, and you'll always meet locals that are just like cooking their greens for dinner or doing their washing, or they've just had a bath. It's very much like a living part of the community, but it's also spectacular just as a something to look at. We've got hot bubbling pools, little geysers, lots of mineral deposits, usually like yellow, red, grey, white, black, all different colours. There's pools that you can swim in, there's pools that you definitely can't swim in. So again, you need a guide to differentiate.
Right.
Our guide from Dide Guesthouse told us a story about some guys from Kiriwina, which is in the Trobriands, that had come down. And it was a very hot day when they went to the hot springs, so there was no steam coming off the pools. And there's a really nice one that you can see right to the bottom. It's really clear and still. And the one decided to jump in. He jumped in. He came up, he's smiling. The second one, he jumps in because the first guy was smiling. He came up smiling, but he wasn't saying anything. And the third guy was like, these guys are smiling, but they're not speaking. And so he stuck his stick in and lifted them up. And he apparently, all the flesh dropped off and just the skeleton came up out of the water. That was the story we got told. So we were very careful what pool we got in. But the pool we got in was a nice warm temperature, but it definitely wasn't going to boil you or anything like that. So some That's nice relaxing hot
something
pools.
To avoid on vacation.
Yeah,
find, yeah,
definitely. Some that you don't want to get in, some that are really nice to get in. And like a hot river that runs around the perimeter, which again, it's a hot place, but in the evening, it was quite nice to get in the hot river. It was quite refreshing, weirdly. And it was nice just chatting to the locals, and they would show us their greens and let us try the food that they were cooking. And our guide from Dede Guesthouse brought things to cook in the hot springs as well. So on the way back, we ate our geothermally cooked bananas and drank our geothermally heated coconut water and things. So quite a cool experience. Besides that, while we were staying there, another thing that we'd heard about from Waiaki at Sibanai Guesthouse was that this area is still part of the Kula Exchange. Now, the Kula is a traditional ring of exchange of traditional items. It's a little bit hard to explain because it doesn't fit with kind of a Western view of value particularly, but they have these traditional valuables called Mwali and Bagi. And Mwali are shell armlets, very elaborate shell armlets. Mm-hmm. And Bagi are very elaborate shell necklaces. And these are exchanged for each other. So the Mwali travel in a anti-clockwise direction, the Bagi travel in a clockwise direction around a ring of islands in Milne Bay. So the D'Entrecasteaux Islands, the Trobriand Islands, I think Woodlark Island mainly. And they travel around. And each person that's involved in the Kula exchange has Kula partners on different islands that they will travel to and exchange these valuables and also feast and make other trades at the same time. So I think it grew up as a system of exchange, but also of cementing relationships across these quite vast distances of ocean in Milne Bay. Now, we were able to go and visit one of these traders. So he was a chief and he had just got back from the Trobriand Islands the day before. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, again, magic involved with this sort of thing. So they have a Kula trading canoe, which has a specific prow board on the front, which is carved to look like a woman and partly the woman's private parts. And that provides protection for the voyage. No women are allowed on the canoe, so this is like just a man's thing. The women stay home and they provide kind of magical protection from afar and guarantee a safe return of the men from the cooler sailing trip. It's not done in the dinghy, so this is done with a big, I think it was maybe like 7 meter long sailing canoe. And it would take maybe a matter of hours anyway to get from Ferguson Island to Kiriwina in the Trobriands in a dinghy, but it took them 3 days to get there. They stayed for 3 weeks of feasting and trading and then 3 days to get back again. So they just arrived back and he had all of the mwali, so the shell armlets that they traded for on Kiriwina, he had them all with him. So he showed us all of those and explained the whole process. And they're like very elaborate. And it's just such an alien kind of thing that it's really interesting to learn about that whole system. And this was another thing that I'd read about before going. back in the early 1900s that this was occurring, and to meet someone that's still practicing this is really interesting experience. And a cool walk there. It's about an hour walk from the guest house along the road, which is a grass-covered track on the island, through the villages and along the coast. And you're always meeting people because people are very interested to have a chat and speak to you. So it's a very interesting journey there as well. That would probably cover like a whole week.
Okay.
Now, with the travel and things, and you don't want to rush it. You need a bit of time in case you get delayed a little bit. So that's a good kind of week itinerary. What I would say, if people have a little bit more time, then you could go back to Aletau and then head south to the Louisiade island chain. We went to Gonabalabala Island, which is basically just a small, picture-perfect tropical island beach situation. There's about 20 villages that live on the island, and they have a couple of guest houses on the beach. The beach is just perfect, and a couple of meters offshore, you can snorkel. And the reef there was one of the best that we went to. I'd say it's probably better than Tawali. Like, a lot of reef fish, a lot of big shoals of fish. Saw a massive lobster. And there is a good place to see manta rays. Apparently, there's a bommy, an underwater kind of hillock of coral under the water, quite close to the shore, where you can snorkel and see manta rays. Again, apparently that's best between September and November. So we're outside that time, and it's best at certain times of the tide. And when we were there, the tide times weren't really working for us. So we didn't see the manta rays. We did see a turtle and lots of tropical fish. And that's quite a nice place. So where we've talked about before, Sib and I and Day Day, you're staying with the family. So you're going to be chatting to the family. You're going to be spending a lot of time with people, which we loved, and we learned so much about their life and their culture and that part of Papua New Guinea. But if you want a bit more of a chill on your own, not too much chatting to local people, then this was very much that. So the family just left us to our own devices, and we just relaxed and chilled on the beach and swam and snorkeled. And that's quite nice if you've been doing that real homestay kind of field travel for a little while. It's quite nice to have that break and just have a bit of time to relax. There's not heaps to do. Like, they will take you on trips to different islands if you want nearby. We did a little dinghy ride around the island, but it's mostly relaxing beach time there and snorkeling. From there, you can also, or separately, go to Samurai Island, which is a nearby island that was once the capital of Milne Bay Province. We're not thinking super historic buildings. It was all burnt down during the Second World War to prevent the Japanese from getting hold of what was there. The Japanese never actually went to Samurai, so it was burnt down with no real reason, I guess, in the end. But it's still quite an interesting place.
The burning it down was successful in keeping the Japanese away.
Yeah, they didn't want it anymore. That's true as well. even though there's not those really historic buildings, it's still quite an interesting place to go. It was the capital of Milne Bay Province until 1968, when the colonial authorities recognized that they were outgrowing this tiny island, which is, I think it's about half a mile long and about a quarter of a mile wide. So it's really small. There was about 2,000 people living there in its heyday. I think it's down to about 300 now. So it's definitely, once the capital moved and once the shipping routes from it used to come from Shanghai, Tokyo, down to Samurai and then down to Australia. Once that changed, then people drifted away, and now it's grassed over streets, big old warehouses from the old international port, these big old piers from the old international port.
And rusty just metal roofs is what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. You're really selling it there.
Well, there's a great website I found called travelobscure.com. That has terrific drone footage of the island.
Yeah, it's true. It has a charm, and I would say...
I was not trying to knock it. I think that does have a charm, actually.
Yeah. And a big part of the charm is the people. Like, the people in this part of Papua New Guinea are amazing. But it's cool to see. You can imagine how it was a bustling port, and now the big wide streets are just completely grassed over, and the massive warehouses are just left empty, and there's just a few locals fishing from what was the international jetty. So it's quite cool to see that. But we also stayed at Maggie's homestay, which It's not got a sign or anything, but if you ask around, you'll find it. It's by the football pitch in the middle of the island. And she had lived there since before the capital was moved. And she knew all the history and she remembered how it used to be. And she would tell us, and she lives in one of these old colonial villas. So it's all patchwork linoleum floors and doilies and china in display cases. And she had lots of very interesting stories about the war and about who used to live here and how it used to be. And that really brought to life like that whole, it used to be such a cosmopolitan place with people from Japan, Europe, America, Australia, and cars on the island. And now it's just such a different place. The one thing that's left there from that time is the 24-hour electricity, which is quite a thing in Papua New Guinea, because none of the other places that we went to outside of Alatau had any mains electricity, but Samurai still has 24-hour electricity, partly from a generator. Now they have solar panels on the top of the island as well. But that was quite nice after the travel we'd been doing, because she had a shower, so a cold shower, but still a shower, which was very nice, and lights and fans and all that sort of thing. So that was a bit of luxury after the previous travel that we'd been doing through the other islands. Now, there's not heaps to do, but it's really nice to walk around the perimeter of the island. Probably takes about an hour. Nice sea views of all the surrounding islands, and you'll see some of the old colonial villas and things like that. And then it's quite nice to hike up to the top of the island, where you'll get really good panoramic views across the China Strait area. Besides that, there's some excellent snorkeling next to the jetty where the dinghies and the trade boats arrive at the island. And okay. There, to the right of the jetty, is basically just a carpet of anemones and hundreds of clownfish just everywhere. And it's not deep, so you can see really well. If you get out to the jetty, there's big shoals of fish under the jetty and pipefish and things like that. That's a really interesting place to snorkel as well. I would say maybe one night or two nights if you want to do a side trip to another island would be fine on Samurai. Okay. And then the final option, if you wanted to add something on to the first part of the trip in the north, you could just get the dinghy across to Wagga Wagga, which is on the south side of Milne Bay. So that goes from the market jetty, so near the market in Alatau. And that's about, I think it's about a 45-minute dinghy ride across to the south side of the actual bay. And so you're back on the mainland over there. And there's a really nice guest house called Ulumani Treetops Lodge. And you can get picked up from the jetty over there, from the shore, and then taken up. Now this, because it's on the mainland, it's quite close to Alatau, there's been quite a bit of logging there. And Warren, who owns the guest house, he had set up this guest house to try and protect some of the forest. So he has this guest house further up the hillside above where the logging was, in the forest, overlooking the bay. You can see right across to Alatau. You look out across the canopy of the forest. We saw so many hornbills. Because you're above the canopy, you can see everything that flies above the canopy rather than just hearing it. You can actually see them flying along. And there's big flocks of hornbills, lorikeets, the eclectus parrots, which are everywhere. They're interesting because they're, I think it's called dimorphic, where the male is one color and the female is a completely different color. So the one is bright green and the other is bright red. Okay. And they're very impressive. And they're everywhere, but they're really easy to see there because you're above the forest canopy. So that's a bit nicer still. So there you've got a hot shower, you've got a kitchenette, so you can self-cater. You need to bring food across from Alatau, but you can self-cater there. Got a beautiful veranda with this amazing view. And it's really well made with like forest materials, but much more of a Western quality than the other kind of village accommodation. Again, there it's a great place to see birds of paradise, so we did actually see them there. Different ones. These were the Raggiana birds of paradise, so I think they're the ones that are on the Papua New Guinea flag. Now, we were outside the display time, so we didn't see them properly displaying.
Okay.
There is much easier to get to the display site than it is at Sibanai. So you don't have to do a two-hour hot jungle hike. You just get a 30-minute. It's a 30-minute ride in Warren's 4x4. You park by the side of the road, and then once you hear the birds of paradise, then it'll take you into the forest. Maybe 5-minute walk, flat-ish, and there's a tree there where they display. Now, it's a little bit sad because a lot of this forestry obviously has destroyed their habitat. So this area of forest, the traditional owner has not allowed the loggers in. And Warren pays when guests come to see the birds of paradise. So he's protecting the forest and he's getting some money to keep the forest. So he's quite happy keeping his part of the forest. But the reason there's so many birds of paradise in this tree is because so many of the other display sites have been logged. So a lot of birds of paradise come to this one tree. Warren described it as a tree full of decorations when they're displaying, because there's so many birds of paradise displaying in this one tree. We saw two male birds of paradise. Now, they lost their big display feathers, but it was still really cool to see them. And the noises they make are very unusual. So lots of popping and weird noises that you wouldn't normally associate with a bird. So that was cool. The only thing I would say is take plenty of bug spray, because this is like lowland forest and there was a lot of mosquitoes. So I think the most mosquitoes I've ever stayed. Good place to go, see the birds, and then get out of there once you've seen them. You're not going to be staying for ages watching them unless you're like very good with mosquitoes. The main thing we did besides that while we were staying there, I think we stayed two nights, we hiked down the 30 minutes to the shore, and there's a shipwreck just off the shore. So it maybe took us a few minutes to swim out to it, but it's very sheltered. And this slopes quite steeply down. So the front of the ship is just poking out the surface, and then the deck slopes down into the deep, and it's covered in coral. You can see down these shafts into the center of the ship where there's coral on the walls and things, and then it just disappears into the darkness of the ship. Lots of tropical fish, and it was just a really interesting topography with all the stuff on the ship deck covered in coral and big shoals of fish around the outside as well. So that was quite a nice different snorkeling experience to some of the other places that we went snorkeling.
Excellent. Sounds like we're winding up.
Yep.
Any last minute advice that we should give to people who are heading to this part of Papua New Guinea?
Any last minute advice? I think I've covered pretty much everything that I wanted to say. I would say getting the public dinghies is best if you can contact the guest house beforehand, because they will know the dinghy drivers and they can book you on the dinghy, tell you exactly where to be, at what time. You might wait for quite a while after that time to go, but like, at least then you know you were looking for this person. And if anyone asks you what you're doing, where you're going, you can say, I'm going with such and such a body to this place. And it's quite nice if you know somebody and you can reference them, because it's quite a small place, so everybody knows everybody. And it's good because they see you, you fit in a little bit more with people. So good to organize that if you can in advance. If you can't, just showing up to these guest houses. There's a few that we showed up to. So Day Day and on Samurai Island, we just showed up and they accommodated us fine. So you don't need to arrange in advance necessarily, but if you can, that's a good option.
Excellent. As we go to wrap this up, you are standing in the prettiest spot of this part of New Guinea.
Yeah, so I'm going to be sitting because I'm going to be in a dinghy and I'm going to be approaching Normanby Island. So we're going towards Sewa Bay. We're just going through the entrance. It's opening up into this beautiful, wide bay, rainforest-clad mountains, all these little stilt villages around the edge, cockatoos, lorikeets flying by, just absolutely perfect.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Papua New Guinea.
Witchcraft. I know there's witchcraft elsewhere, but witchcraft. So we chatted to quite a few people and there's a strong belief. So we were told by multiple people that mostly in Milne Bay province, people don't die of natural causes. It's mostly witchcraft. And that's jealousy. So we were chatting to one guy whose father owned a guest house in East Cape. And we'd read about the guest house. We hadn't found anything recent about it. And he explained that his father owned the guest house and then he died, and he died from jealousy. So when people get jealous, they will put spells on you and they will die. And because he died from witchcraft, the family were too scared to carry on the guest house. So they stopped the guest house. They just stopped the guest house because of the jealousy and the witchcraft. The interesting thing, when I asked how old his father was when he died, he was 78 when he died. So I would say that's one thing that I've not experienced. Even where there is witchcraft beliefs, that was quite an extreme version.
Huh. All right, then. And if you had to summarize the Milne Bay area of Papua New Guinea in three words, what three words would you choose?
I think I'd say people. The people were so generous and so welcoming. I'd say nature, both above and below the water. The nature is just spectacular. And then I would say an adventure. Like, this is an adventure.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because I enjoy the mix of shows, obviously, that I have on the show. We were talking, well, it'd be 3 weeks ago now when you hear this, or 4 weeks ago, you know, about a luxury cruise. And now we're talking about taking, you know, when you talk about taking these boats over to the island, 30 miles over to the island or something like that, I'm seeing 10 people in the boat and kind of running low in the water.
Yeah.
Getting your own life jacket seems like a good idea.
We had a bound pig in the boat with us once, a live bound pig as well. So, yeah, there's all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yeah, I get the adventure thing. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Our guest again has been Chris Shorrock from travelobscure.com, which is this great website I found. I see a number of posts on Papua New Guinea, but if we wanted to feature just one, the best post that people should go to if they were thinking about doing this trip, which one should we feature?
I would say the one about Day Day Hot Springs. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah, a real highlight.
Got it. Excellent. And as I said, drone work and things like that included in this. How did you keep your drone charged if you were places without electricity?
So we have a small solar charger ourselves. Sib and I guest house on Normanby Island, they had solar charger and solar lights.
Okay.
And then the other guest houses would have generators that they turned on in the evening for a few hours. So we used those as well.
Interesting.
And we had some spare batteries.
You would have to.
Yes.
Excellent. Chris, thanks so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your obvious love for Papua New Guinea.
Thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. That was awesome.
A special thanks to the patrons of Amateur Traveler who help support the podcast financially. If you're interested in learning more about becoming a patron of the show, go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. Or if you just want to pick up an Amateur Traveler mug to put on your desk at work and start a conversation about great places to travel, go to amateurtraveler.com/store. You can find mugs, hats, shirts, water bottles, and more on the Amateur Traveler store. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more.